I hope you all enjoyed, I think you did, because a lot of you are still deeply engaged in discussion. That's wonderful. We have about 10 minutes to have the panel respond to some of the questions that were submitted, and then we'll go from there. I love the questions. There's a large number, however, and we probably will only get to a couple, but I'll, this will be indicative of the things that I appreciate. But the first one is for the panelists, what's your 30-second stump speech for why employing global youth is important to people living in developed communities? Don't all speak at once. Okay, Ethan.
You mean developing? Wait, is this one on? This one's even more on. I'm going to assume that it means developing communities as opposed to developed communities.
It says developed.
Oh, it's the right thing to do. I'm sort of joking, but the fact of the matter is, we have a responsibility in the developing world, not to mention an economic opportunity that is double bottom line. It's good for us. It's good for them. One of the things that we have got to do a better job of, and India is a particularly good example of this, which is to say that the American India Foundation, for example, has done a really good job, I think, in partnering with government to expand opportunity and to scale our programs. What we haven't done a good job of is working with the business community and helping them to understand, in the same way that we're having companies that are doing really amazing things here that are double bottom line, doing good while doing well, that's something that we need to export.
I'd like to echo that, if I can.
Please.
ENTRA 21 is funded by the Multilateral Investment Fund of the Inter-American Development Bank, which is a multilateral institution. But we also have very strong funding from corporates like Nokia. And these are multinationals in developed communities, and they recognize that it's good business. It's good business to invest in employing global youth. And so, for instance, Nokia has offices all over Latin America. There's a plant on the border of Mexico, just on the other side of Texas. And I'm developing a project there right now. And they're extremely excited about having ENTRA 21 there because they need highly skilled youth to come and work at their plants. And so it's about aligning.
But it's a lot easier to convince business. So let's say you're talking to the average family in Kansas. And what they're saying is, well, I mean, why should we be expending these efforts elsewhere? We need it at home. Let's have the arguments for why it's important to that family in Kansas that this be done.
Mm-hmm. Hello? I think you can break it down to a couple of things. One is a term that's...
Can you hear?
Can you hear me?
Okay.
A term that's being used here is globalization. When you have depressed areas of the world, you breed a number of things that include everything from conflict to disease. When you begin to lessen the pressures that lead to those particular factors that I mentioned, you are actually lessening your own risk. Because it doesn't take much for a disease to be incubated in a Congo and be in New York City in 18 hours. Not to say that an increase in education will directly impact that, but when people's levels of health are impacted, when they have a reason to go to war more so, it might not affect you directly, but it will affect you indirectly, whether you live in Kansas or Anchorage. So that's what I would have to say.
Good. Thank you. Did you want to add something?
My response would not be nearly that eloquent. I think I should just defer. But as someone in an agricultural region. I think farmers know that inherently. We need for global youth to get an education, to get good-paying jobs so that they can buy rice, corn, soybeans, and all of those other commodities that we produce. And, you know, if you've bought milk, eggs, bread, or anything else lately in the supermarket, you know that they need good-paying jobs.
Thank you. Here's another good one, I think. How can schools assist students in overcoming basic barriers to their education, food, health, water, et cetera? I think you've used different models. You've alluded to a few of these. Just give us maybe one or two examples of this from your experience. Yeah.
Well, a couple of the examples I gave earlier actually speak to a couple of these things. One of those examples happens to be an initiative in I could almost call it a sustainable village as opposed to a school in Benin in West Africa, where the students or individuals who attend this institution find themselves producing a large percentage of the protein requirements that they require as students. A similar example, but you know, maybe 5,000 miles away in Central Africa, as in Rwanda, where you have research institutes tied to a university actually assisting local institutions generate biogas to also lessen their energy requirements. So from a developing country perspective, it's very essential that individuals are equipped with skills that are practical and relevant and allow them to enhance their creative abilities.
Now, this is a bit of a different model from what most of us here know. There is an extreme bias, I would say, in most of our institutions against things that are practical. And certainly on the basis of credit. So how do you get around this problem in working, especially with educational leaders, convincing them that there is value in doing things like that. Stephen.
I think in our own case, we've seen firsthand the sort of impact that it could have. You know, I've said that I could improve our retention significantly if someone would give me 20 cars that run and a mechanic that could keep them running, because over and over we see our students are committed on the margin. They come to us believing that they're going to fail, and then when the fuel pump goes out on the car, it convinces them that yes, they were right. They can't afford to get it fixed. They drop out.
But you're doing that. How do you convince other leaders to do that? What would you say to them that would persuade them that it's valid for them to do it as well as for you to do it?
I don't think there's the logic that would convince them. I think that there are the numbers that would convince them. And I think we can point to improved student success. You know, the goal, regardless of whether you're a community college or a private university, is for students to complete their education. And I think you have to let the numbers speak for themselves.
Thank you. We're over time probably, but there's time for you to respond.
I just wanted to raise one more point. And this is something for everybody to be conscious of. This is not just a problem for education. The NGO community is notorious for not being able to build partnerships and cooperate. And obviously a big part of that is competition over scarce funding resources, et cetera. And so one of the things that we really encourage, and as I said, we work in three pillar areas of education, public health, and livelihoods. In places where we have educational interventions going on in certain circumstances, we're also providing, to answer your first question, we're also providing basic health care and 2,200 calories a day of food and overcoming some of those things. But optimally, that shouldn't be the way that it's done. Optimally, our education partners should be, I don't want to say compelled, but yeah, compelled, to partner with, instead of an education organization getting into the role of trying to become an education and healthcare organization, they should pull on board a partner that they can work with that can provide that, and the two of them, and then maybe we can make some grant money available to them as well. That's the way that it works well, and that's how I think you catalyze that kind of change.
Terrific. I know that, David, you're lurking. It must be your time.
I hope that's good news.
That's good news.
So hopefully this will add a little bit more juice to this conversation. These are the themes and the gems that came from you. So I'll just read them. First of all, provide opportunities for college students to mentor and develop relationships with students of all ages in impoverished areas. Universities should provide resources such as technology, textbooks, and students with technical expertise to train locally and abroad. Incorporate practical vocational skills into a standard education. Tackle barriers to education, including hunger, transportation, and childcare. I think we heard a couple ideas about that right now. Higher education should be free for people who otherwise can't afford it in both the U.S. and abroad. And finally, improve the quality of nutrition of all school lunches, particularly the free ones. And here are your gems. So first of all, create a parent education allowance for parents coming out of generational poverty to help provide their children with needed school items. Do a school system exchange program of students and administrators between developed and developing nations. And finally, I like this one a lot. Create a mobile educational institute that would go directly to U.S. factories to teach laborers the skills they need to compete and contribute to the changing international economy. Back to you, Dr. Sismonds.
Terrific. I actually didn't get a copy of those, but thank you. Fantastic. Of course, I'd like for any of you to comment in whatever way you want on these, but I'll begin by saying that one of the things that we are, in fact, doing is creating that exchange program with between students and administrators between developed and developing nations. That's one of the projects that our Vice President for International Affairs has undertaken for our campus. What would you like to – these are very provocative – how would you like to comment?
I'd like to respond to the first theme in terms of opportunities for college students to mentor and develop relationships with students. I mentioned the Delta Bridge Project, and one of the reasons that it has worked is that we have partnered with the University of Arkansas Clinton School for Public Service. If you're here with the Clinton School, raise your hand, okay? Their very first cohort, about 15 students, that during the spring semester they had to do an internship, a domestic internship, and they spent the spring semester working on the Delta Bridge Project in Phillips County. And the resources they brought were immeasurable. As a result of their involvement, we have a sweet potato distribution and storage facility that is run by a cooperative of African-American farmers. We're probably the only county in the United States that envisions a sweet potato as an agent of social change. We have a thriving Boys and Girls Club. We've got a fixed route transportation system. There are very tangible outcomes because they brought those skills to bear. They were wise enough not to come in and impose their ideas on the community, but work side by side to implement ideas that the community had already developed. We have had smaller numbers back each year since then. And if you compare that impact to just the people in this room, there's the people in this room represent a wonderful resource that can be brought to bear both in this country and outside
Absolutely.
Of this country.
I wonder if you, looking at the gyms, what would be the business model for creating the parent education allowance for addressing the issue of generational poverty so that they could provide the resources that children need in school? How would you do that?
That is a great idea. I'm not
it is a great
exactly
idea.
Sure how the parent education allowance would work, but one of the things that we've tried to do is to provide.
How much would you think it would take for each family per year?
I don't think the answer is simply money. I don't think the solution mm-hmm. is simply money. I don't think the issue. One person agrees with me.
Okay, two. Is that third? Okay.
Because that culture of poverty is simply not a lack of money. I think we have one of the things that we've tried to do is to recognize the student, that the student exists as a member of the family, and we have social gatherings where the children are invited. When we have when we award scholarships, the children are invited. They can bring as many of their family members as they want. We have to find ways of making the parent or the family a part of the educational process. Now, you know, I think dollars are part of the solution, but I think the answer is not so much the allowance.
It's not the only solution.
Coming
is what up you're
with
saying.
Ways of working with the entire family structure.
It's not the only solution, but
I would hazard,
as someone who grew up with no books at home, I will tell you that it would have made a difference to have pencils and paper and
sure.
books at home. It does make a difference. So it's not the only solution, but it's certainly one part of the solution. What about this idea of a mobile educational institute going to factories to retrain? Does anybody want to speak to that one? Anybody out there want to speak to it? Yes, okay.
And in Arkansas, we have an obligation to serve our community by doing that.
Our workforce development programs already do that. We train people in our local plants to use Microsoft Office software. So where a guy was normally walking around the plant reading the meter and then handwriting a report in, he's now putting it into Excel and emailing it. And then I'm teaching him to use his email to make sure that the guy he sent it to doesn't say, oh, well, I couldn't do my report because so-and-so didn't send me his report on time. I'm showing him the date and time stamp on the email proves you did it on time to help him save his job. So our community colleges in this country are helping do that as well. And I like Dr. Murray over there a whole lot because he's doing exactly what I think we need to do to help our working poor because, as I told him earlier, everybody here in this room made over a 19 on the ACT. The people that go to our schools didn't make the 19 on the ACT. They graduated from high school with a 1.0 GPA, and we have to educate them because they can't get a job. They can't feed their families, and they will continue to create that generational poverty. And as he said, you know, with the economic impact, for both of us, the students don't need money for school supplies because their financial aid is covering it. They need money to fix the car. They need money to pay the light bill. They need money to do these other things so they can stay in school because, like you said, they'll drop out.
Now I want you to give your name as a panelist.
My name is Kathy Harrell, and I'm a graduate student at the Southern Arkansas University, and I am the academic advisor for South Arkansas Community College in El Dorado, Arkansas.
Outstanding. Thank you. Okay. That was wonderful. I'm going to ask the panel if you would want to take one of the themes or nuggets and select something that is of interest to you to comment on.
I actually wanted to piggyback on what Stephen was saying about the first theme in terms of just the importance of really having a mentor. That's just a basic component of positive youth development. It's really important for youth to have a role model, and that's something that our programs at the International Youth Foundation all have. We strongly believe that every one of our programs, you know, there needs to be someone, a mentor, preferably someone from the youth community who can really create that caring environment in which youth can really grow and have that example to follow. It really gives them hope. Like I was talking earlier about not having a sense of future. When a young person from a poor community sees that someone who came out of their own community or a similar one was able to achieve something, it speaks volumes. And that's just something that I think we haven't done maybe such a good job of in the United States of really integrating as part of our education system.
Yeah, I wanted to add one thing about the whole issue of mentorship. I came here today in large part because this was a group of young people. And that, I've got to tell you, it is so exciting for me to see a room full of young people who are excited about doing good in the world. I mean, that's a huge thing. You will all, if you choose careers in this path, make less than you would working in the corporate world. But I've got to tell you, it is worth so much more to me that I feel excited going into the office every day, feel like I'm making a difference in the world. It's critical. Now, having said that, and I was having a discussion earlier today with a young gentleman who was maybe getting a little bit cynical about some of these things. And what I will say to you is this. There is a great opportunity for mentorships, not only for you, and again, this is why I came today, not only for you, but for the mentors. You bring to us new ideas. You guys aren't scared. You'll try anything. You don't know if it'll work.
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But we bring with us experience. And so my point to you is only this. Mentorship is a two-way street, and I say that not only for you all out there, but for us up here who mentor people as well, and it's something that we all have to remember on a day-to-day basis.
Emeka?
I would like to just add or develop the first theme, which refers to relationships with students in all ages in impoverished areas, and build into that students in developing parts of the world. And I think too often we are daunted by programs that don't seem to work because they are considered to be of white elephant size, or they're just too huge, there's too much hierarchy involved, too much bureaucracy. But as I hope I've demonstrated, there are projects out there that are working, that are granular, that are that could provide the catalyst, that could catalyze change in a number of different areas, and they're very accessible. And I think if we look at these small distributed initiatives, we could engage them and actually see quite a bit of success. And I encourage everyone to seek them out and work with the individuals involved.
Terrific. Were you about to raise your hand? Okay. You were about to be on this stage. It's a good thing you put your hand down very quickly. We have some exciting commitments to announce, and we're going to go into that part of the program. Let me ask Xian Chao, a graduate student at the University of California at San Diego, to come forward. I have the pleasure of describing these projects, which are very exciting, and congratulations on that. Through the Rural China Education Foundation and working in collaboration with a partner at Peking University in Beijing, Xian will coordinate the purchase of 15 copies of 500 high-quality children's books, 7,500 books total, to distribute to 8 villages. In schools in rural China, educational materials and equipment are often lacking or of poor quality. Rural income lags 3 to 4 times behind urban income. By giving young children more access to quality reading materials, Xi'an is helping to bridge this disparity. This collection alone has the potential to reach 800 students and 100 rural teachers. Now, I've got to find your certificate. Are they in order? I hope. Good. Thank you. Please give her a hand. Thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, this is wonderful because the spirit of this kind of enterprise is really not just coming and sitting and listening to people talk, and not just coming and listening to people talk and leaving with nothing in hand. This is all based on the premise that we can learn from each other and that we can come up with concrete ideas, and then, most importantly, we can implement them. So the commitments are an extremely important part of this program, and I encourage you all to think about commitments for the future, because they make a huge difference in terms of getting some very practical models in place to advance this work. I'd like to ask Donald Hughes of University of North Carolina, Greensboro, to come forward. Hi, Donald. How are you? Your commitment is to establish a training and mentoring program to help ensure homeless high school students in Greensboro, North Carolina, to give them an opportunity to attend college. That's terrific. Over the 9-month school schedule, this program will help high school students with their schoolwork and prepare them for standardized tests such as the SAT while providing them with college admission workshops. Mr. Hughes is working toward a partnership between UNC Greensboro, Guilford County School System, and the local homeless shelter in order to launch the training program. The program will rely on students and faculty from UNC Greensboro to run the training program. Mr. Hughes will establish a mentoring program in addition to the college preparation courses and training to support transitioning into college life in their first year. Mr. Hughes, I want to say, drew inspiration for this commitment from his experience as a homeless student. Thank you for remembering what's needed and wanting to do this for others. Thank you so much. Inspiring, really. I'd like to ask Ramya Pratawadi from Columbia University to come forward. Be careful. I just saw your president last week. Yeah, it's very, very nice. Very nice man. The organizations involved in this are Columbia University Engineers Without Borders and Gram Vikas. And the commitment is to help jumpstart the economic and social progress in a rural Indian village cluster by installing a micro hydro system by summer of 2008. This project in Purnaguma. All right, what is it?
Purnaguma.
Okay, that's what I said. Orissa, India. Will provide the village cluster of 250 households, which currently relies on firewood and animal waste matter as energy sources for lighting and cooking, with enough power for indoor and outdoor lighting, a mechanical water pump, a grain mill, a fridge for vaccine storage, and possibly a computer for the school. The organization is raising $56,550, which is necessary to fund this project. Recently, they received a $10,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency and a $15,000 award from the Environmental Resource Management. A team of 4 students will travel to the site this summer and work with village residents to construct the system. And another team will return in December for a follow-up assessment. Now, I want to make sure you follow this story. And so you're going to give us the name once again of the village so we all have it sealed in memory.
Purnaguma.
Purnaguma. Thank you. Congratulations. I'd like to ask President Skorton from Cornell to come forward. I don't usually use titles, but I thought I'd do it for you, David. Okay. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
You did a great job today.
Thanks. This is...
And your students are at our table. They think you did a good job, too.
Okay, good. Thank you. The commitment of Cornell is to create real-world solutions to issues of sustainability by creating the Cornell Center for a Sustainable Future, focusing on economic development, energy, and the environment. The value of this is $50 million. In order to develop practical, innovative solutions to global challenges, Cornell will create the Center for Sustainable Future. The center will focus on economic development, climate change, the environment, as well as interactions between these issues. More than 300 Cornell faculty members in a wide range of disciplines are already active in sustainability research. Through this commitment to action, the center will enhance its ability to leverage and implement its discoveries, particularly by building new external partnerships. Internal competitions will create incentives for researchers to develop breakthrough solutions to some of the world's most pressing sustainability problems. This is very exciting, David. Very. Thank you. Congratulations. Oh, you brought your own press?
No, it's against the rule to have your own press. I don't know who this guy is.
David, honestly, I can't believe you brought your own photographer. I'll have to remember to do that next year. Thank you so very much, all of you, for these extraordinary commitments. Let me say again, a number of us have really been anticipating this meeting and so proud and excited to have students involved. Those of us who've been participating with CGI for some years particularly have longed to have you a part of this process. After today's activities, I can see why. This is a level of energy that we longed for. It's here. It's now. But one of the most important things about this project is that you connect with each other and that you take back not just ideas for your campuses, but that you find a way to promote the collaboration among institutions. The presidents who met today at noon talked about that very idea, or ideal, I should say, the notion that we are all connected in this endeavor, and that if we only make those connections stronger, we will undoubtedly have much more success in addressing these problems. I want to thank the panel for doing a wonderful job. Thank you all for coming. And thank all of you.